the panel on RNZ National. Quite a lot of feedback about jigsaws, actually. And by the way, Rebecca Wadey has got in touch with us about that piece. And ensemblemagazine.co.nz is the place that you can go to find out more about her article there. Ronald says, I've been sitting listening to you as I do my 1,000-piece jigsaw, which I started today. 1,000 pieces up is the only way to go. It's very relaxing and satisfying. Today on the panel, one political commentator who joins us very soon, in fact, on why the red tide could actually be seen as a win for the centre-right constituency in New Zealand. Find out more soon. Also today, about half of the contents of landfill should not be there, says waste educator Kate Mead, saying that much of the material doesn't break down. And a new warning flashing up on classics like Peter Pan and Jungle Book, to quote, this program includes negative depictions and or mistreatment of people or cultures. So we discussed that as well with Lila Hare, a former politician and trade unionist, and Scott Campbell, who is a public relations consultant, former reporter for Three. First up, though, a marine electronics engineer tested positive for COVID-19, the Ministry of Health confirmed yesterday. The man had been working on several ships in the lead-up to his positive test result. Now, the case is being treated as a border incursion instead of community transmission. And 29 people aboard the Ken Rees ship are sitting in the waters off Napier at the moment, waiting to be tested for the virus, considered close contacts of the country's latest community case. It appears to be the first New Zealand case definitively linked to a seaport and shipping. And there has been surprisingly little talk about ports, said Professor Michael Baker. Well, with us now is Professor Michael Plank from Te Pūnaha Maritini at the University of Canterbury. Professor Plank, kia ora, welcome to the panel.
Kia ora, Wallace.
Being treated as a border incursion instead of community transmission, can you explain that a bit for us?
Yeah, that's right. So the genome sequencing results have come back today, and what they show is that there's no link to the Auckland cluster. So that suggests very strongly that this person has caught the virus while they were working on one of these ships in the last week or two. So, yes, it seems like that's by far the most likely explanation, is that this is a case where the virus has come in across the border, in this case through a port.
So this case does show that all the right things happen. Contact tracing systems did kick into gear and that type of thing, Michael?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is a really good example of the systems working well and stopping, hopefully, the transmission from spreading any further. And the person got tested pretty much straight away after they developed symptoms, which is really, really good. And the man's to be applauded, in fact, for coming forward for testing so quickly. And then the person's close contacts have been tracked down. I think that his family members or household members are in isolation at the jet park, and they've been tested, and his other close contacts have been traced very quickly as well. So, yeah, the testing and the contact tracing has really worked very well in this case.
Mm. Having said that, I think, was it Michael Baker who said, we're seeing COVID-19, it's still intensifying around the world. Will keeping COVID out of the community be an ever present challenge, one that just keeps on, trying to find a way to get in?
Yes, I mean, I think it is going to be a challenge that's with us for the foreseeable future, and one that we just have to be constantly ready for and constantly, on the alert for, whether that's coming in through travellers, through quarantine facilities, or through a port, as in this case. We need to have those systems in place, testing systems, and the general sort of community readiness for cases like this. And what I mean by that is the contact tracing. So it's really important still at level one that people keep a track of their, keep a record of their movements and their contacts. Obviously using the app to scan in is the best way to do that. And so it's still really important that people continue to do that.
Yes. Lina, have you got a question or a thought of this? An ever-present reminder that now it's ports this time that we need to be vigilant on as well.
Yeah, a couple of things. One, a question. This person was symptomatic, but just out of interest, what is the kind of protocol for testing court workers, how frequently do they are they tested when they're not symptomatic?
Yes, I believe they have different categories of worker depending on what the level of risk is, whether they are, you know, going on board ships, being a high risk type of worker, or whether they're just actually working on shore. I believe this person was being tested fortnightly. And really, I think if people are going on board ships for their work, they should be being tested weekly. So the problem with being tested fortnightly is, I mean, you could have a negative test result on the Monday. You could then go to work and get infected on the Tuesday. And then you've got a whole 2 weeks in which you could potentially be passing the virus on in the community before your next scheduled test. So really, I think if anyone's having contact with people on board ships, with international crews, they should be getting tested weekly.
There has been some commentary or questions over the last couple of months about people saying we just need to accept that it's coming and get ready for it. And is this sort of an example of that? It's going to break the borders at some point, isn't it?
Well, I mean, yes, it is. We've seen that it's come in through the border on several occasions now. But in each of those occasions, we've managed to stamp it out very quickly with minimal disruption to the community. So I think it's been a successful strategy so far, and we need to keep that strategy up. If you look at what's happening around the world at the moment in places like the US, the UK and a lot of Europe, you don't want to go down that road. If you can at all help it, those countries are in dire situation at the moment. And so the longer we can keep COVID out of our community, and so far we've been very successful at it, the longer we can do that, the better.
And what a relief it was yesterday to have the election behind us, because, you know, when we heard about this particular case, it was just so great that we heard about it in a kind of non-political way with good information about, you know, how it's happened and a reasonable line of questioning around, for instance, whether testing of port workers should be more frequent, without the kind of hysterical overreaction that just seemed to be inevitable at any moment of concern over the last few months.
Or muted, perhaps. Yeah. Professor Plank, thank you very much for your time. It is 15 past four. Lorraine says, Wallace, in my view, people are hardly using the COVID Tracer app nowadays. I've witnessed. How do we deal with this? Do we make it compulsory? The panel are NZ National, Scott Campbell and Lila Haro with us now. Now, on to the election, an extraordinary night in many ways, much of which has been discussed and dissected. So, five parties in Parliament, Labour 64 seats, National 35, Acton Greens 10 seats, Māori Party as it stands, one seat. We'll hear our panel's view on what they took away from the night. With us, Lila, for example, tweeted, person for person, this will be the most left-wing parliament since 1938, not to be hidden or squandered, organised, sensible, collaborative and radical. But one seasoned political commentator has said the election could also be seen as a win for the centre-right. To explain, Tim Watkin runs the Pundit blog, also co-host RNZ's Caucus podcast with me, Tim. Kia ora.
Kia ora.
What an extraordinary...
Am I seasoned?
I said seasoned.
Whether I'm still a fresh young chick.
Whether you are or not.
A bit of salt and pepper on the
but
side.
That's quite a comment to make.
So here's how the theory plays out, right? Was there an election this weekend? No, here's how the theory plays out. That you've got what looks like a red tide. That's the word that everybody's using, right? Labour have suddenly swarmed into the best results since 1938 for the left. Peter Fraser did 55%. This 49.1% is the best since then. But where has that boosted vote came from? Labour has spruiked its support up from the past election. Where's that support come from? It's from a lot of people who have crossed the blue line. You look into some of those seats. I mean, it's fascinating. Only four electorates gave National won the party vote. The entire South Island, not one seat did National win the party vote in the entire South Island. You've got the safest blue seats in the country, like Selwyn, going from a majority of nearly 20,000 down to 5,000. Labour won Ilam, for crying out loud. I mean, there was, we were talking about it on the night. It reminded me of that quote from Longy when he was appalled that, you know, that Labour came within 400 votes of winning Remuera in 1987. What have we done to our people? Now, this is different. I'm not saying that there's any betrayal implicit in this, but the betrayal could be coming.
People voted tactically.
They did. I think there's a lot of people on the centre-right who looked around and said, right,
we don't want the Greens.
We don't want the Greens to have all the power. We want that handbrake. Winston was desperately charging around the country saying, look over here, I'm the handbrake. And what, the centre-right voters went, nah. Don't think that's credible anymore. Don't see the numbers there for you. National's not going to do anything. They're toast. Oh, I can see some Conservative politicians who have been very limited and careful in their approach to government, who have ruled out a whole bunch of tax change and have ruled out a super change, have set debt limits on themselves.
No capital gains tax, no wealth tax.
Done very, very careful. Oh, it's the Labor Party.
Right.
Let's vote for them.
Interesting.
And so I think we're going to see some fascinating tensions. People like Lila will be saying, come on, Labor, deliver to your base. But there'll be the mandate, potentially, is there's a whole bunch of centre-right voters who have said, nah, Labor, do nothing.
Let's go around the panel.
Well, I think the first thing is that the mandate is for the Labor Party manifesto. I mean, there's no...
Which is pretty tepid, right?
Well,
I mean, by your standards, it would be pretty limited, I would have thought.
It's not completely tepid. I mean, okay, if you look at the industrial relations policy, you have the increases in the minimum wage,
yep,
the extension of the living wage beyond the core public service to all contracted services to government, which is actually going to have a massive impact beyond government because, you know, these people are going to a cleaning company, security,
yes,
companies and so on. They work across the public and private sector. And I know where I'd want to work if I was a security guard. You have fair pay agreements coming in. So that, you know, that's a transformational change where we are going to see the reinstatement of a kind of an award system,
right,
across whole industries, which obviously Winston Peters prevented happening in the last time round.
Yeah.
So you've got all the explicit stuff in the manifesto and, you know, there's some significant stuff there. But you also have the day-to-day decisions and calls that a government makes in response to particular kind of challenges,
yes,
and issues, and you have an environment in which, at least for the time being, you can meet some of those needs through borrowing, and there is an acceptability of borrowing. So I think for people like me, the biggest concern is that they seem to have ruled out a kind of redistributive approach in the tax system.
Yep.
But there are other ways of funding some of the investment that has to be made to deal to poverty and in particular child poverty. And I don't think you can escape the rhetoric of this election. I mean, Jacinda Ardern is not planning to stand up in 2023 and say that increases in the number of children experiencing real hardship is okay because we got 7 of the 9 indicators.
But she's been using that 7 out of 9 line the whole time and saying material hardship, we're going to ignore that.
In this election,
yeah,
after this very short and very kind of difficult period of government.
Yep.
I bet my bottom dollar she's not planning to stand up and say that again.
Well, it's where are the policies that get you
I think policy-wise, I think she'll push, but I don't think she'll go all the way transformational. And I think that there is that huge, there's that swing voter in the middle, which is what you're talking about. Mm. They are the former National voter, or they might have been a bit soft National, but they've voted for Labor to try and keep the Greens out. That was what the tactical part of it was. I think we have voted hugely for a mandate of Jacinda Ardern. I think outside of that, you'd struggle to get a lot of Kiwis who will be able to tell you the top 5 or 6 ministers outside of Jacinda Ardern, right?
Yep.
You've got Grant Robertson,
yep,
David Parker, Chris Hipkins, and then people will start to struggle after that.
True.
I think that they unexpectedly won some of the electorate seats that they wouldn't have thought they were going to get. I think Labor, and speaking to some of the Labor MPs, they knew that they were going to have a high party vote. They knew they were going to get there, but now they've got some confidence in some of these electorate seats, and some of them that have been true blue seats for a very long time. So just that will obviously give them some type of feeling of confidence to actually go and do something now. And I hope that they do pick up some transformational stuff. I think it is, the Prime Minister talked over this election, over the last 3 years, about climate change being our nuclear-free moment. And what I think the numbers also show in this election is the huge turnout of young people and then Māori voters who just poured in some really big numbers in advance, which we haven't seen before. I think the failing of National is that it does not represent the New Zealand of today. And I think that is what the Labour Party is
Isn't
showing.
Isn't it funny how quickly we're saying that? You know, that was it's 4 years.
Well, just echoing what Tim says, perhaps, essentially, this is what Jim Boulder said to Newsroom. Essentially, we've done nothing apart from passing a Zero Carbon Act, and that had the support of the whole of Parliament, moving to green vehicles and all that. None of it's happened. So here we have Jim Boulder saying he's not confident that a transformational economy will happen.
Those specific things didn't happen, and we know because it's on the public record, because of Winston Peters and New Zealand First. So, you can fully anticipate that those kind of initiatives will happen. But also, I mean, there is a lot, they are a long way up that majority number now. I mean, between Labour and the Greens, you're getting close to 60%. In order to form a government, you probably need around 47, 48. So there is absolutely room, provided that Labour and the Greens can present themselves through whatever arrangements they come to, and we're not talking specifically about that, but present themselves in 2023 as a continued stable government. I don't think there's any reason to believe that, you know, that we can't go over the next 3 years without some pretty significant change. And
give us an example before we go back to Tim.
And they've got a fair bit of capital to burn.
Give us an example of the one change that we really need to see before we go back to Tim. The one change that you would like Labor to do?
I would really like to see increases in core benefits.
And that's not going to happen?
Well, I wouldn't assume that. I mean, they have increased core benefits this year by $25 a week. And they have.
But you're talking about the 47% that the welfare group's recommending, right?
Yeah, so I think that there is the scope to do that. They have ruled out significant tax changes already, but there is the potential to test out some of these ideas in an environment where we accept borrowing to solve some major social challenges.
Yeah, my one thing is not really policy-based. It's to just have the, I don't know if you can say this on air, but just have the balls and the courage to actually go. I think we've given them a mandate. I just hope that the Labor Party takes that on board and actually goes and does something. You could go through their manifesto, go through all sorts of policies and look at the best ones that they could do, but I just hope that they do something.
Look, I just think it'll be interesting to see how they read the mandate. That's exactly the question to me, is when they look at this and break down the figures, what do they see as the mandate in this? I don't disagree entirely, but I just think Lila and a lot of people on the left will be going, yep, this is a clear opportunity now, and yep, they've got political capital to burn, but we've been saying that for the past 3 years and they haven't burnt it. So what's going to change? Is this really so significant? I just think we're actually instinctively looking at the character of these politicians. I think Ardern and Robertson are conservative, have shown themselves to be pretty conservative operators.
This is where I think you actually have to look at the team that's come in this round and in this election. And, you know, we aren't looking at people who've come through what's become the standard Labour Party career path of, you know, working as ministerial advisors and in public service offices and so on, and on a Labour Party career track. I mean, you have people coming in who have serious records of achievement in a whole range of sectors in this caucus. And I don't think they're coming in to eat their lunch, as they say.
But I do think, though, that the Winston handbrake that, you know, has been there over the last 3 years, though, COVID is still going to be a handbrake for us. And the fact that we don't have deep enough pockets to do a lot of this stuff. I think the expectation on Labor is going to be huge. And people will be saying to them now, go and make these big changes. But the transformational stuff that we are talking about is not going to be fixed in the next 3 years. But what I said on the greatest political podcast ever in the caucus recently.
Caucus, I believe that's awesome,
caucus,
Scott.
Which is basic. Jacinda Ardern has the opportunity to take the next 3 years and either be the Prime Minister for the next 12 or 15 years, for as long as she really wants to, or they might crash and burn. It's one of the two. That's for me.
That's part of my point about the tensions they've got to choose. Is that do they actually get runs on the board quite quickly for the people who are poor and the marginalised and the people they're supposed to stand for, or do they actually build this great big centre government for life kind of tradition?
Or they do both. I mean, there are plenty of runs they can get on the board simply by implementing their manifesto. They make continuous decisions day by day. Yep. In terms of what to go next. And if you look at issues like, for instance, KiwiSaver or working for families, neither of those were manifesto commitments of the relevant Labor governments. Those were brought in during a term of Parliament. I mean, whether you criticise them or not, they were certainly transformational in terms of their scope. There's talk of social insurance type arrangements, which could take some of the pressure off the basic welfare bill and transfer it into a different funding form. So there are actually plenty of options they have.
All of which are things they can spend money on, but they've sealed off just about all their routes to how they actually raise money to pay for these things.
No, you can raise money through a social insurance scheme. I mean, you have an overfunded ACC scheme at the moment.
Yeah.
If you switch that to pay as you go, as we used to have, and which was completely viable.
The
losses and political losses in playing with ACC were when they shifted from a pay-as-you-go system to an insurance model. You could unwind that, and suddenly you have a whole bunch of ACC levies, transferred to sickness.
What they don't have, though, is somebody to blame. And that's where I think at the moment that might be the thing that holds them back. Because with this expectation, they don't have the ability. They've got a mandate. It's a strong mandate. And they don't have the ability to say, we couldn't do it because of that person.
OK, so let me ask around the panel before we go. And I want to hear the listeners' viewpoints on this. 2101 is the number to text. Should the Green Party be part of the government inside cabinet? Should it be around the panel?
I think that they should be in some type of agreement. I don't think inside cabinet.
All right, Lina.
I think whatever arrangement is made, that the key consideration should be how Labor and the Greens present themselves to the electorate in 2023. So whatever way they choose to go about that, and it may be incremental, so it may be that they come to an arrangement now which can change over the next 3 years. But the key consideration is the ability to win a Labor-Green majority in 2023.
I think it's all very wise, but I think the reality of the numbers we saw this weekend is that actually Jacinda Ardern is the person who decides that. We can say what we like, but she has all the power to do whatever she wants. The Greens have very little say in that conversation at all.
I've got to come back to Lina on that one.
Well, I agree. I mean, that's obvious. The numbers speak. And I'm actually in two minds about what's best for Labor and what's best for the Greens
in terms of that.
We don't have time on the panel to go through the machinations of my imagination.
If we look back at this election in 50 years' time and the students will be looking back at great elections, how will this election be remembered? Just quickly around the panel, Tim, you first.
Oh, I'm going to quote the Chinese general and say it's too soon to tell. It'll be what they do. That's my point. It'll be what they choose to do with these 3 years. Will they choose to actually build a long-term government, or will they choose to actually be more activist? And I don't think they can necessarily do both. That would be an immense political skill if they can do both.
I'm going to draw on the wisdom of my 30-year-old son, who said that for him, in thinking about the implications of this election, he keeps realising that every kind of thing he calibrated politics against has changed. The nature of Parliament has changed. He has never lived in a time or been aware in a time where Labor held seats outside of the urban
cities,
areas.
Yeah.
I mean, for me, you know, as a young person, we saw those provincial electorates changing between Labor and National, you know, when the government changed.
Right.
So for him, you know, this is a transformational electoral picture.
Well, other than RNZ's election coverage, for me, it's the stardust of Jacinda Ardern. That's exactly how I think it'll be remembered. If you look at 2008, I think it was the John Key effect, and now you've got the same thing with Jacinda Ardern. And I think going into last week's election, you know, Labor's advertising had changed where it was, "Hi, I'm Jacinda." And it was all around sort of that effect. And I think, though, to her credit, she has managed some pretty big crisis. And I think that that's what it'll be remembered for.
Scott Campbell and Lala Hari with us. Tim Watkin, thank you very much.
Thanks, mate. Scott, we'll continue this on Thursday on Caucus, out about lunchtime.
Yes, absolutely. Good to listen to. 28 to 5, time for headlines.